This is One-on-One with Mark Bonteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
He's one of the greatest basketball players ever to come out of the state of Indiana. And his life after basketball hasn't been bad either. He excelled in every sport as a high school athlete in Terre Haute. In fact, he's been voted the best athlete ever to come out of Vigo County. He played on a world championship Babe Ruth baseball team, finished second in the state track meet as a hurdler, and was all-state in both football and basketball. Football was his favorite sport, but he went to Purdue on a basketball scholarship and excelled immediately. He was second-team All-American as a sophomore and first-team as a junior and senior. He led the Big Ten in scoring all three of his varsity seasons and scored a record 52 points against Michigan State. Some of his school scoring and rebounding records still stand. And so does his status as a member of the legendary 1960 Olympic basketball team that was the best of all the U.S. teams until the 1992 Dream Team came along. 50 years ago, he was the starter on a team that dominated the competition by an average of more than 40 points. He averaged more than 25 points as a rookie in the NBA, earning Rookie of the Year honors, despite only playing on weekends because he was continuing his studies at Purdue. He took 2 years out of his NBA career for the Army and played 9 seasons overall. But that wasn't the end of his professional success. He became an orthodontist, building a successful practice in the Portland suburbs that he still works part-time. In fact, he owns a patent on a revolutionary device that corrects overbites far more economically than anything in the past. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Terry Dischinger. Well, today's one-on-one episode comes to you over the phone line with Terry Dischinger. Terry is in Lake Oswego, Oregon, just outside of Portland, and this is a man who Indiana basketball fans should know more about because he's really one of the all-time great players from the state of Indiana. Terry, you grew up in Terre Haute, went to Garfield High School, and I know your father was a football coach. I've read some things that maybe growing up that football was your favorite sport.
That's right. Football was my favorite sport in high school. I liked knocking people down, running into people, and it was just a great joy for me to play that sport. You can be aggressive because you learn the techniques, and so you can be aggressive. You know, basketball back then, it was like, especially for me, if I blew on somebody, they'd call a foul. So, I mean, it was tough. You know, the big guys back then, it seemed like they wouldn't let you be aggressive. I mean, the game has changed so much.
Now, your father, was he a coach at another Terre Haute school, right? Or was he
no,
at Garfield?
He was coach at Garfield.
He was coach at Garfield, okay.
Yeah, now, he actually was assistant football coach when I was in school because he had to retire for a year because he had like a spinal fusion operation in his back. And so, but he wanted to still coach because he's still a young man. And he was mainly, he was a baseball coach. Well, the coaches coached everything back then, but yeah. He was head baseball coach, head football coach till he had to retire. Then he was assistant football coach and assistant in basketball.
Okay. Now, did he, you know, what was his role in your athletic career? Did he kind of push you into it, or did he, you know, did he sit back and just watch and let you do your thing? Or what kind of, as a coach, what kind of role did he play?
Well, it was special. My dad was a special guy. I don't know if you know his background. He played at Indianapolis Tech.
Right.
With Leroy Johnson, I think, or
Leroy Edwards.
Leroy Edwards, and I mean, they had a fantastic basketball team. And he was four sports, and he went to Indiana and chose to play football, although he played a little basketball down there for a while. He was a great athlete, but he was just a great guy. It's interesting, one night in football, when I think I was a freshman, might have been a sophomore, he yelled at me, and I says, "Dad, you know me well enough, you don't have to yell at me, never again." But we would talk sports, he took me everywhere. I mean, and I played four sports in high school, and he and Willard Kurt started the baseball, Little League Baseball in Terre Haute. And they ran the baseball program in the summer, and one year I played baseball every night of the week, 7 days. I was like a major leaguer, and he was really great. Some people thought he pushed me. It was interesting. Bobby Kurt, you know, Willard Kurt's son, we grew up together. He played at Purdue some. We were at our 50th high school reunion last year, and he says, boy, your dad really pushed you when you were in high school. And I says, you know, Bob, I didn't feel that at all. I really didn't. I think he was a support, and he didn't really push things on me. I would bring things up to him, and we could talk about it. And I felt very blessed to be able to have that relationship with my dad, and I miss him a lot. I do things now, sports-wise, and I think, boy, I wish Dad was here with me to enjoy this.
Yeah, well, just so people know, we mentioned Leroy Edwards, known as Cowboy Edwards. He played at Kentucky and then played professionally as well. One of the great players of his era, really.
Right.
And I believe it's Eric Montross's grandfather or great-grandfather. There's a relationship there. Kind of a small world in the state of Indiana high school relating to basketball. And you mentioned baseball. You played on a world championship Babe Ruth team as a first baseman.
Yep.
And then you also were all-state in track. What events did you do in track?
I was a hurdler. And I think it was one of the greatest things I did to aid my basketball career, because my big strength in basketball was my quickness. And when you run hurdles, it's like playing basketball. You know, you run in between each hurdle. It's kind of start and stop, although you run through them. And so I got to the state meet my senior year. Well, I got state meet 3 years in a row and didn't qualify for the finals and the highs. And I didn't run the lows. You know, I was 180 then. Now I think it's 300 or whatever it is. If it had been 300 when I was in school, I probably wouldn't have run it. 180 is far enough. But anyway, in my junior year, a fella hit a hurdle and fell in front of me in the highs, so I didn't qualify. My senior year, I qualified, and I got third. And then in the lows, I got second, which is a speed race.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed track because it was an individual sport. You know, you didn't have to depend on your teammates. I'm not saying it's not fun to play team games, because, you know, it's great, because that's what mostly I did. But I really enjoyed the individual aspect of track, and it helped me physically so much, because when I got in high school, you know, I'd trip over the cracks, you know, walking down the sidewalk. And by the time I was a senior, I was the fastest person in the school.
Sure. Okay. Now, if I had talked to you, say, as a 15-year-old kid while you're still in high school and asked you what you wanted to do with your life, would it have been professional athlete or would it have been something else?
It's a great question, Mark. When I was in the eighth grade, we had what we called homeroom, where you'd report each day, you know, and they'd take attendance and then you'd do some things. And so we had to write a paper about what we wanted to do when we grew up, and I wanted to write about becoming a professional basketball player. And my teacher says, you can't write about that. You got to write about something worthwhile. So I wrote about becoming an engineer, and it was really interesting. When I signed my first pro contract, the teacher sent me a note.
Ah.
Says, remember what I had you do in the eighth grade?
You got the last word on that one, didn't you?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's one of those things. You get the question all the time from young people, how did you become a professional athlete? I says, well, you enjoy the sport, you play hard, you compete hard when you're in high school. If you're good enough, you get to play in college. And then you go to college, and you still need to enjoy it and really have a passion for it. You compete, and if you're good enough, you get to play in the pros.
Yeah.
Now, the key thing is you have to enjoy what you're doing, or you'll never make it.
And that's, I think, a lot of kids today, they're forced to play so much. You got to play AAU all summer. You can't play other sports. You have to specialize, and I think that takes a lot of the enjoyment out of it.
I think so. I really do. It's interesting. I was talking to Gene Cady. He talks about these guys getting hurt all the time. And he says, you know, Terry, they play basketball year-round. We used to play other sports, and we allowed our bodies to heal from the sport that we were in. I says, you know, Gene, that might make sense.
Yep.
Because, and, you know, the thing that's so much fun about sports is competition. And, you know, so much of it, you know, they're in one sport, they don't get to compete in different ways. You know, football's an entirely different sport, team-wise, than any other sport. And then baseball, you have another set of skills. And, you know, and then track, I already talked about that. And you put all those skills you develop in those other sports together, and it makes you better in the sport that you end up choosing. And one of the things that happens with specialization nowadays so early is kids get weeded out until they're mature to the point where they can really choose and can really they can really decide, you know, who are the best athletes. And I think it's sad the way they're picking all-stars in the fourth grade and all that.
Oh, yeah. Dischinger becomes an Indiana All-Star, then wastes no time becoming a star at Purdue as well. He does it so quickly, in fact, that he makes the 1960 Olympic team after his sophomore season. All of that when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Today's guest is Terry Dischinger, who became an immediate success at Purdue and became a starter on the legendary 1960 U.S. Olympic basketball team after his sophomore season. Here's Dischinger on his fast rise to the top. Did you go to the state high school basketball tournament as a kid?
I sure did. My dad was the coach, and I actually saw the Milan game.
Ah, okay.
It was the first state tournament I got to go to.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sitting up in the corner directly in line with Plump when he shot the last shot.
That's great. You know who else was there? The Van Arsdale twins were sitting on the floor for that game.
Wow.
Their dad was an usher, and they actually got to sit right on the floor.
I roomed with Tom a little bit in Detroit, and then he got traded. And just this last December, I got to have dinner with Tom and Dick.
Ah.
And I had my daughter with me, and it was just a special time. They're special people.
Yeah, oh, great guys, absolutely. I'd like to figure out sometime all the people like yourself who were at that game, because I know Del Harris, the NBA coach, you know, from Plainfield, was at that game, still has his ticket from that game, and you were there. Van Arsdales were there. I'm just curious of all the people who were there as little kids who went on to have great basketball careers. It'd be interesting to know.
It's amazing. I was in Australia lecturing orthodontics. And we go to this, the host people take us to this restaurant. The wife's brother owns the restaurant. And so we go in there, and seafood's a big thing in Australia. So he gets fresh seafood. He's got it specially for us because his sister and brother-in-law were bringing these friends into his restaurant. And so my wife orders steak. And so we get ready to leave, and he goes up to her, and he's got his lower lip out like he's pouting. Steak. She says, I grew up in Indiana. He says, Hoosiers.
You'd seen the movie, huh?
And as soon as she told him that, he was all smiles. He wanted to talk about the game and the movie and all that.
Yeah.
So Hoosiers is known in Australia also.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, it really is amazing. I got to believe as a kid, just going to a game like that, it had to be so inspiring just to play the game yourself.
Well, you know, I as soon as games were over, I had to go and play.
Yeah.
I had to go and play.
Now, you got out of high school in 1958. I'm curious, were you disappointed not to be Mr. Basketball?
I wasn't. I was just happy to be on the All-Star team. I mean, growing up, you know, I knew it happened. My senior year, I knew I was good, but I really didn't think about it. And I remember when I got the letter saying I had been picked number five. I was in the starting lineup. My dad came up, got me out of class, and showed me the letter, and I thought, wow, I'm on the All-Star team.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, back then, the Indianapolis Star, the top five vote-getters were automatically the starting five.
Yep, and I tell you, I had so much fun in those 2 weeks on the All-Star team. You know, they bring you to Indianapolis, you get to eat at a restaurant every night. You know, you stay in a motel. We even got to go out and drive around the track at the 500. And we just had a ball. And, of course, the year before, I think we'd lost two, and we stuck it to Kentucky and beat them twice.
You swept Kentucky, yeah. Mike McCoy out of Fort Wayne was Mr. Basketball that year. He didn't wind up having nearly the college career that you did. And you scored 23 points in the second game down in Louisville to get that sweep, so you enjoyed some success there.
Well, that was an amazing thing. You know, we go down there. Of course, we'd played in Butler, and, you know, that's special just to be in there. And then we go down to Louisville, and they got the Freedom Hall. It's the biggest place I'd ever seen in my life. And we go out there. The baskets look like they were like thimbles. But we play, and we got behind early, and then we just came roaring back, and I really had a great game and was important to have that so we could win. That was really a lot of fun.
Why did you pick Purdue? Was it because you wanted to go into chemical engineering, or were there other factors as well?
You know, it's interesting. My dad would take recruits to the different schools, and I'm all growing up, and I get to go. And I just always felt at home at Purdue. And I just liked the people. I liked the atmosphere. It turned out to be a real special place for me. You know, I just cherish the time that I spent at Purdue. And the people haven't changed. You know, they're the same type of people that were there when I was there. I'll give you an example. Coach Eddie, we had finals, and we were playing Ohio State that weekend, and we had finals week. He gave us 2 days off to study.
Wow.
How many coaches would do something like that?
No, not today.
And the president of the university, President Hubdy, he was at practices. Red Mackey was the athletic director. He would play golf with us. You know, I know times have changed. It's a whole different thing now because there's so much money involved. And I'm not talking about the old times are that much better than the new times, because I think sometimes that's sour grapes. But I really loved being at Purdue, and I really liked the people.
So your dad, having been an IU graduate, he didn't put any pressure on you to go to Bloomington?
Well, I'll tell you what my dad told me. Somebody asked, what's the best advice that a parent has ever given you? And Dad never let me talk any recruiting. He told me when it was all over that I had 100 offers in basketball and 50 in football, and I didn't even know. Well, I knew the first one was from Idaho, Moscow, Idaho. I thought that was on the other side of the world. But anyway, he says, Terry, I don't care where you go to college. He actually wanted me to go to DePaul because he thought that might be better for me. And I says, Dad, I want to play Division One. I want to go to a Big Ten school. And he says, well, I'll tell you one thing. He says, I don't care where you go in the state of Indiana. He says, decide what you want to study. And he says, I want to watch you play. It was a great decision for me. And I know it's entirely different for these kids today, but you know, I went to school with my friends. You know, I was close to home. The sports writers knew me. Plus, they're my people, Hoosiers, you know?
Yeah.
And so I chose to go into engineering because that's what they had at Purdue.
Right. Chemical engineering major.
I was a good student. So, and actually, you know, my engineering degree really paid off for me later as far as what I'm doing right now.
Sure. You're an orthodontist now, and we'll get into that later. But yeah. I'm curious, what was Big Ten basketball like in your era in the early 60s? You know, Ohio State has a great team with Jerry Lucas and John Havlicek and Bob Knight's on that team, but it's a completely different era. A guy like me who was a little kid then might romanticize it a little bit, but it seems like it must have been a lot of fun, and if you were capable of scoring as you were allowed to score. I mean, so it seems like it must have been a whole lot of fun, even if you didn't have quite the team success that you wanted.
Well, you know, we really, if we were playing today, we would have great success because we would have played in the NCAA 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
You know, and the Big Ten in those days, I mean, Indiana's got Bellamy. Ohio State's, you know, their team is one of the greatest teams ever. If they would have won another NCAA or, you know, they're in the finals 3 years and they won as sophomores, they probably would have been acclaimed the greatest team to ever play. And, you know, I'm kind of prejudiced. I think they were one of the greatest teams ever. And you scored a lot of points.
Yeah.
You know, because we ran the ball up and down the court.
Was it, you're a three-year captain at Purdue as a sophomore. You are a second-team All-American just 12 games into your first varsity season because, again, this is when freshmen aren't eligible. You scored 43 right. points against Illinois. Later on, you grabbed 26 rebounds in a game against Wisconsin, which was one short of the school record. So you had immediate success. And I guess going chronologically, after your sophomore year, you're on that 1960 Olympic team, which is until the Dream Team came along in 1992, that's really the best U.S. Olympic team ever in basketball. Oscar Robertson, Jerry West, Jerry Lucas, Walt Bellamy, I think 10 of the 12 players on that team went on to play in the NBA.
Yeah, three were rookies of the year.
Is that right? Okay, well, that had to be an incredible experience. You guys just storm through it. You dominated it, but it must have been just a great thrill to be on that team.
Well, it's surreal, Mark. Here, it's the first year I get to play in college. You know, Oscar and West and those guys, they were my heroes. I watched Oscar when I was in high school. He was a senior at Attucks. I watched him score 42 in the final game. And he was my hero.
Yeah.
As a basketball player, and I didn't have a lot of heroes, I felt comfortable in myself, but he was special, and so here I end my sophomore year, and I had a great year. When I went to Purdue, I figured I'd start as a sophomore, but I had no clue how good I could be. And my freshman year, I was very fortunate that we had our freshman coach was a man by the name Paul Hoffman, who played pro basketball.
Yeah.
And I think I made the most progress that year that I ever made in athletics. I don't know what my career would have been if I would have had to play as a freshman, because I don't know if I was ready to play as a freshman. And so I know why they do that today, but I still think it's better if you can spend that year as a student. And I was very happy that I spent that year as a student, but I improved so much as a basketball player, and it was great. And so then I play my sophomore year, and I get selected for the Olympic trials. So I go to Denver. I'd never been on a jet plane. I fly into Denver in a jet plane and see the mountains. Mm. I'd never seen mountains.
No mountains in Terre Haute, are there?
With snow on them. And I get there, and I'm just happy to be there. I'm not thinking about making the Olympic team. And I'm on a team with Oscar and West and Bellamy. Lucas wasn't on that team because Ohio State played as a team in the trials. They had eight teams there. And so I was on the NCAA All-Star team. And I get chosen by Pete Newell, who was our coach, to be in the starting lineup. And the NCAA All-Star team had never won an Olympic trials, and we played three games. They had eight teams there, and we won all three. And the rules were that they had to select a minimum of five and a maximum of seven players from the winning team. I was in the starting lineup. I'm on the Olympic team. I was up all night. The selection committee announced it at 6 a.m., and I called Mom and Dad and said, I'm on the Olympic team. It's still seems kind of surreal.
Yeah, it really does.
I know it happened, and every year when they have the Olympics and they have that opening ceremony, I just think, wow,
yeah.
I was part of that.
Yeah. So you say you stayed up all night because you couldn't sleep because you were so excited, or?
I just wanted to find out as soon as I could.
you didn't want to...
The Olympic team. I mean, when I heard, how the selection was made, I thought I didn't think they could leave me off because I think I averaged 14 a game, rebound-wise. I mean, I had a really good tournament there, and I figured since I was in the starting lineup that I would make it, but you never know. Then here I am on the Olympic team, and I get to spend that time with West and Oscar and all of them.
Dischinger completes his career at Purdue and wins the third straight Big Ten scoring title with defensive help from his Olympic teammates. Back on One, Mark Monteith here with former Purdue All-American Terry Dischinger. You might know that Dischinger won three straight Big Ten scoring titles, but you may not know how he got that third title over IU's Jimmy Rail with a little help from his friends at Ohio State. Did that team have any trouble meshing because he had such a great collection of collegiate talent? Did everything come together pretty smoothly, or was it difficult for a while?
Well, I was just there. You know, I was just playing. We played, I think, three exhibition games here in the U.S. against ABL teams. And the first team we played, I think, was the Cleveland Pipers or something. And Lucas and I were not in the starting lineup. And we lost the game. People probably don't even know that. We lost our first exhibition game. And my dad told me that Pete Newell told him after we'd gotten back from the Olympics that after that game, Oscar and Wes went to see Newell and says, if you don't put Lucas and Dischinger in the starting lineup, we're going home. Now, I don't know what that had to do with it, but I tell you, if I got open, I was never missed on that team. People don't realize we had our point guard was Les Lane, who was playing AAU ball, great passer, but Wes and Oscar and Lucas, they're all great passers, you know, and we were a team. I think that's the thing that we can say. People saw all the stars, and they thought, well, you know, they just had tremendous talent. But we were a great team. We could play. Every person on the starting lineup could play all phases of the game.
Yeah, I've read where you were kind of regarded as a defensive stopper in that group.
My understanding, that's why I was in the starting lineup in the Olympic trials, is because Newell, he is a defensive-minded coach, and I could do the things that he wanted me to do. You know, one of the things that people didn't know about that Olympics, it was a round robin. So it wasn't that you played in your group and then you moved on. They went by point total. At the end, if two countries had the same record, then they would go by point spread. So we couldn't take any time off when we played. We had to run the score up as high as possible. So if we ended up with the same record as another team, that we could still win, but, you know, we didn't even think about losing. I mean, you know, U.S. basketball was so much further ahead of the world at that point in time. The world was just really getting into it. I mean, the Soviet bloc countries were at every one of our practices, videotaping. It was amazing. They had great athletes. They really had great athletes, but they didn't know how to play basketball at that time.
I saw they had a 7'3", 320-pound center.
Yeah, but he didn't play against us.
Okay.
They had a 7-footer that started in place of him. He wasn't quick enough. But, you know, it was a funny thing. They used a basketball that was kind of like a soccer ball. Part of the idea was that the foreign teams would have more of an advantage. It was a disadvantage because and the ball didn't bounce right, you know, when you dribbled it, mm-hmm. and it was hard to shoot, kind of floated. But we were so much more skilled than they were, it really was a detriment with them as far as ball handling and all that, and we could pressure them full court because we were so quick. It was just an amazing thing to be a part of that team, and it's, you know, the Olympics is a special thing. It's unlike any other competition you ever go through.
Yeah, certainly, and that Olympics in 1960 in Rome was really kind of a momentous one in general. In fact, an entire book has been written about the Rome Olympics, and the basketball team is included in that. But you guys averaged 101.9 points per game.
Yeah.
You won your games by an average of 42.4 points per game.
Yeah.
That tells you how dominant you were. You were the fourth leading scorer, averaged about 11.8 points.
Yeah.
So... do you still have memorabilia from your Olympic experience?
I do. I have. It's really interesting. When I started practicing orthodontics, you know, I had my gold medal and my uniform, and I thought, you know, should I put this in the office? And I did. I had it framed, and it's still in the office. And it's been so special because people don't get to see gold medals. They don't get to know an Olympian, and it's really been a neat thing, the reception that I've gotten from the people that come into my office. The mom take the kids over there and say, look, he played in the Olympics, and he's smart enough to be an orthodontist too, so you know, you can do athletics and be a student.
Sure. Well, that Olympics, you have to go back to the real world, so to speak. You go back to Purdue for your junior season, and I know you missed a few weeks of class, didn't you?
Yeah.
And then, but your junior season, you become a first-team All-American. You lead the Big Ten in scoring with 28.2 points and 13.4 rebounds per game. Let's go to your senior season then. You score 52 points against Michigan State. And on that very same day, Jimmy Rail scores 56 for IU. I've seen the paper from that day. So you kind of got overshadowed a bit, even though you scored 52 points.
Well, you know, it was that was the only game home game my parents missed in my career, was that Michigan State game, because we had a snowstorm and they were following the snow plow and they got stuck at Crawfordsville and couldn't go any further. And I think I scored the last 28 points or some ridiculous.
I think you scored 20 straight points.
Something ridiculous. And it was just like, you know, they talk about people being in a bubble. I mean, I was in a bubble.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that, you know, it was just a runaway game or anything like that. It was a close game all the way through, and I needed to score for us to win, and it was just one of those nights, and the fans were going crazy. It was just, it was so much fun to be out there, you know. When you can't miss and they can't stop you, it's a special feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I have an interesting story on Rail.
Sure.
And you may know the statistic. I won the Big Ten scoring championship 3 years in a row. And I mean, I wasn't aware of all this. But my senior year, we were playing at Michigan, and Indiana was playing at Ohio State. And Rail and I had the same number of points scored in the Big Ten going into that game. And I got a telegram from the Ohio State team saying, "Do your thing, Terry. We'll take care of Rail." I think that's the greatest compliment that I ever got as an athlete.
Your Olympic teammates were going to take care of you, weren't they?
It was special. I mean, I could not believe it when I got that telegram. And they gave it to me before the game at Michigan. And Michigan wasn't very good then, but we were playing there. And so 12 seconds to play, we were tied. We called timeout. Coach Eddie says, "Terry, you're going to get the last shot, and this we're going to do it." And I put the last shot in with 2 seconds to go, and that was the end of my career because only one team went to the NCAA back then.
That was a storybook finish for you, though. Like you hit the game-winning shot, and you also become the Big Ten scoring leader for the third year in a row. I read where Rail scored like 25 that day, but he only had about 10 or 15 against the starters against Ohio State. And you had a big game, so you wound up with the scoring title. You averaged 30.3 points that season and also 13.4 rebounds. And you were talking about 13.4 rebounds. Nobody does that today.
The fact that you average a little bit over 30 points a game, you know, you think about that in today's world, you'd be all universe.
Sure.
It was special. You know, the sad thing for us is Ohio State was just so good. We couldn't beat Ohio State. And only one team got to go to the tournament.
I'm curious, do you have any memory of Bob Knight as a player in the Big Ten?
A little bit. Not a whole lot. I don't think he started ever.
Not routinely anyway.
I do remember we played at Purdue, and I remember him making a drive across the free throw line and running into me and making a shot. I don't remember him too much.
Yeah, I remember listening to him speak once in West Lafayette before IU played Purdue. This is back in the 1980s, and he made the comment that the Big Ten had never had a better player than Terry Dischinger. He was pointing that out, you know, and that people would have known him better if he had played on a team like Ohio State that went to the NCAA tournament.
Well, maybe, but, you know, I went to the pros and did pretty well.
Yeah.
Dischinger goes to the pros, and it does work out. He becomes Rookie of the Year in the NBA, despite playing a part-time schedule. When One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, and today's guest is Terry Dischinger, the Terre Haute native and former Purdue All-American. Imagine this. Dischinger played his rookie season in the NBA while still attending classes at Purdue to complete his degree requirements in chemical engineering, and he was still named Rookie of the Year.
Let's talk about that pro career. You know, you're unique because you, I guess, must have had it set up from the beginning that you're going to be a part-time player. You're going to graduate school during your rookie year in the NBA. You only played 57 games because of your classroom obligations. You were the first pick at the second round by the Chicago Zephyrs in 1962. Yeah. Now, was that because you had already kind of made it clear that you were going to be a student as well?
Well, here's the deal. I actually didn't go to grad school, but I was in engineering, and I took a full load every year, but most of the time it took engineers 4.5 years to graduate.
Oh, okay.
And I could not get courses in the summer, so I had to go during the school year, and I felt it was really important to get a degree. I mean, my parents drummed that into me. It's school first and sports next. And I actually was going to play with the Phillips 66 Oilers in the AAU League because I was an engineer, and that was a great opportunity with that company because most of the high people in the company were ex-basketball players. And it would give me another chance to go to the Olympics. And so that summer, I got married, and we went to Bartlesville, Oklahoma, and spent the summer, and I decided I didn't want to live in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And besides that, I wanted to play in the pros. Mm-hmm. And I told the pro teams that, you know, what I was going to do, that I was going to graduate. You know, I was going to go to school and graduate, but I was going to play with Phillips. And then, of course, I changed my mind, and Chicago drafted me in the second round, and so I went to Chicago. And so I was the only player ever in the NBA to be a part-time player.
Well, you are co-rookie of the year despite your part-time schedule. You average 25.5 points and 8 rebounds per game. Did you find the NBA maybe a little easier than you expected?
Well, I had confidence in my ability, but I had, you know, I just was looking forward to playing.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing season. It really was. Playing in the pros is just fun, I felt. Play against the best players every night, get paid to play, beats working. And, you know, it's a dream. That was the dream, and there's so many kids that have that dream. And when you get there and you're able to perform in the way that I was able to perform, I didn't go in with any preconceived ideas on how good I was going to be or what it was going to be. I just wanted to play. And it was a fantastic season, and I had a lot of fun.
So what are you doing? Are you making a lot of trips down to West Lafayette for classes while this season's going on, or how are you doing your schoolwork?
Well, here's the way it worked. I just played the first half of the season on weekends and holidays.
Weekends and holidays.
Yeah, and I was at school the rest of the time. It's funny, I didn't go to training camp either, except for the final scrimmage. And Jack McMahon was the coach. Jack got fired later in the season and Slick took over.
He's a player coach.
Yeah, as a player coach. And then he was retired and just coached
right.
In Baltimore the next year. But so I go to training camp and I get there and they're gonna have the final scrimmage. You can imagine what the rest of the guys felt like. Here I am, you know.
I was gonna ask. You're just showing up for games, not having to do the dirty work.
Yeah. I mean I can't believe it. But anyway, so Jack McMahon has me out on the court and he's showing me the plays. And so I play the game, the scrimmage, and I play well. And he comes up to me after the game and he says, "I'm sure glad that you can play, that you're a player." And so we start the season and I'm coming off the bench. And that's fine. I could understand. I mean, how could he put me in the starting lineup when I'm not there every night?
Yeah.
And so we played a Friday night game against the Celtics in Chicago, the first time I played against Russell. And we get to the fourth quarter. I hadn't scored. He wasn't going to let me score. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get a shutout here. I've never had a shutout. I got 6 points in the last quarter, so I didn't get shut out. And the next night we played in St. Louis, and they had Bob Pettit, Cliff Hagan, Clyde Lavellet, all that great St. Louis Hawks team. And I scored, I think I scored 30 in the second half. I didn't start, but from that point on, I started every game that I was there.
Did the players have any resentment toward you for not, because you didn't practice with them, you just showed up and played when you were available?
Well, you know, maybe, but it didn't seem like it because I could play.
You were helping them win.
And I could play, and it was interesting. We were playing on the West Coast. Back then, they only had two teams on the West Coast. They were in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And so when you'd go out, you'd play two games in each city, you know, a little bit like baseball. And so we had a Friday night game in San Francisco, and they had already played there one game. And so I leave West Lafayette at 4 in the afternoon and play a game in San Francisco that night. They tape my ankles in the cab on the way from the airport.
Wow.
And then we go to Los Angeles and play two games. And I fly the red eye back to go to school on Monday at Purdue.
Yeah, that's amazing. Nobody can tell those kind of stories. You're all on your own in that regard, no question about it. What was your salary as a rookie?
I think it was $20,000.
Well, that's pretty good then.
It was
for
really
that era.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, my wife just corrected me.
Oh.
You know, I heard she's downstairs listening to this.
So what does she say?
Said it was 25.
25,000. I think that was great for 1962.
Well, my understanding was John Barnhill made the all-rookie team in St. Louis.
He later played for the Pacers.
Did he play for
in the ABA for 1 year? Yeah.
Yeah, he was a little guard, about 5'10 or 5'11. Really quick, good player. And I heard that he made $6,000 for the season. And the next year, after making the all-rookie team, they wanted to cut his salary.
Yeah, that's the NBA of that time.
Yeah, it was.
That's
it
why
was.
We have a union now.
Well, it's changed a lot. You know, people ask me, they say, don't you wish you were playing now? I says, no. I said, because I probably wouldn't be an orthodontist if I'd gotten paid the way I pay him now. And I really loved my profession since I didn't play basketball.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure you had more fun as a player then, too. Less pressure. And it's more of a game than it is today, no question about it. How often do you get back to Indiana?
As much as I can. I always come back for the 500. I don't know why I enjoy it so much, but I do. I went to my first race when I was 11 and bought my own tickets. It's just a special weekend. We come back on Friday for Carburation Day, and then we play golf on Saturday and go to the race on Sunday and stay downtown. And so walk down memory lane. It was really interesting. This year I got passes in the pits, and I'm sitting on the pit wall, and David Letterman comes out. And he played basketball at Broad Ripple with a very good friend of mine. So he walks in, and I'm sitting there. He goes right by, and the Letterman-Ray Hall pit was right next to where I was sitting. And he has two big state troopers with him. And so I asked one of the state troopers, is it okay if I say hello to Mr. Letterman? He says, sure, go ahead. So I introduced myself and said I had a friend that played high school basketball with him. And I said, I heard that you kept everybody loose. And then he says, who'd you say you were? I says, Terry Dischinger. And we had a nice talk for 5 minutes or so.
Yeah.
It was kind of special to be recognized. And then I see Brent Musburger, you know, because he does the pre-race stuff. I mean, you see everybody because – you know, at that race, everybody from Indiana's there.
That's
and
right.
And then they sing Back Home Again in Indiana, and it's just like, wow. this is like a walk down memory lane. Okay. I try to get back for a football game every year, and I try to get back for a basketball game.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is from Lafayette, and so, you know, we have friends back there that we love to see. I mean, there are no better people than people from Indiana. Regular great people, and I cherish my heritage, and I love being there. But I love living in Portland also.
More with Terry Dischinger when One on One continues. That's it for today's episode of One on One. Thanks to Terry Dischinger for sharing his story. You know, time didn't permit me to get into the 2 years he spent in the Army amid his NBA career. He was a player coach on an Army team based in the South Pacific during that time. Or to tell how he went to dental school part-time over the summer while still playing in the NBA. He went on to build a successful orthodontic practice in the Portland area after finishing his career with the Trailblazers. He's turned that practice over to his son now, but he still works part-time. And patients still get a kick out of seeing his Olympic uniform and gold medal in the office. Dischinger, by the way, was contacted by the Pacers when they were formed in 1967, and he was interested in playing in his home state again. But he had 1 year left on his contract with Detroit, and the Pistons wouldn't let him out. Now, don't forget, if you missed part of this episode, want to hear it again, or want to hear one of the other conversations with an Indiana sports legend, all you got to do is go to the website at 1070thefan.com, click on the one-on-one window at the bottom of the homepage, and you'll have access to the podcasts of all the episodes of this series. You can email me anytime at mark at 1070thefan.com, and I'll be back next week with another guest, right here on 1070 The Fan.